Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Mike Boris and this is Straight Talk.
One of the things I get out of this, Ben, is that you're really intense.
Oh, shit, yeah. Look at the eyes.
Ben Fordham. Welcome to Straight Talk.
Hello, mate. I've worn the Mark Boris.
You have? You got it on.
Black T-shirt on. I used to go into radio stations with Dad on weekends, and I'm 13, 14. I thought, I can't believe this is a workplace. That started it, and then I worked there all through year 11 and year 12.
That's pretty strategic for a young kid to take $6 an hour to put himself out when all your mates were going out and having their fun and stuff like that. Are you a strategic person?
Yeah, absolutely. But you know what it is? It comes from fear of failure and nothing else. And then on the Sunday before my first show, Mum and my brother and my sister came around for breakfast and I started crying my eyes out, bawling my eyes out.
What, anxiety?
And I think the first ratings came out and we rated 17. We went up.
Use your power as Prime Minister.
Banyan, thanks for coming in the studio.
I said you were.
Then radio, mate, there's something special like this. Good question. Jeez, that's a good question. My boss has told me not to talk about this, Tom.
Good.
So, which
Tom,
is why,
hope you're listening.
Which is why I'll talk about it, obviously.
Ben Fordham, welcome to Straight Talk.
Hello, mate. I've worn the Mark Boris.
You have? You got it on.
Black T-shirt on.
Was that your brother or your mum or someone instructed to dress her?
I've just always been watching the podcast.
No, but you get instructed by your mum still. I know that. I mean, even when you have a little accident in the car, you still ring up mum and say, tell her straight up that she's, by the way, she is the matriarch of your family.
The big kahuna, we call my mum.
Yeah, the big kahuna.
And I make no apologies for the fact that, yes, when I have a small bingle in my car, as I did last week, I ring mum and say, who's the smash repairer? She goes, how old are you? You know, there are those little things. I don't know what's going to happen when mum's not around anymore because all of a sudden that fountain of knowledge disappears and we'll have to probably Google stuff.
Can we talk about the Fordham family for mum?
Sure.
It's not just Ben Fordham. There's a big family. There's a brother and a sister. Your brother, of course, is one of my partners in this business. And your sister is successful in her own right. And, of course, there was your dad, John, and your mum. And, by the way, your mum and your dad, everyone knows John Fordham as the, you know, the talent manager, blah, blah, amongst many other things that he was doing. In my lifetime when I dealt with him, because he managed me when I did the TV show, John was a larger-than-life figure to me. He's an older guy than me, but he knew everybody and everybody knew him. And he looked like he was in the middle, when it comes to entertainment, TV in particular, or sport, he looked like he was in the middle of everything.
Mm.
What was it like growing up with someone like your dad? And by the way, your mum, because your mum was a backbone behind him.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that Dad found a way of being involved with all of the people who he admired without being a specialist in any of their fields. For example, he grew up loving sport and he found a way of being involved in sport, you know. Someone like Mark Boris or Richie Beno or Andrew and Matthew Johns, a whole range of people he's worked with throughout his career.
Ricky Stewart.
Ricky's one of his greatest mates in the world. And he found a way through his business of being a PR guy and also being then a talent agent. He was one of the first talent agents in Australia, of being involved with all of these people who he quite liked and quite admired, even though he couldn't kick like Andrew Johns or he couldn't bowl a ball like one of the great cricketers who he looked after, you know. So it was an interesting business model, but Mum played this important role in the business because Dad was the flamboyant ideas man. where mum was the one who'd actually work out how the bills were paid. So I remember overhearing early on, because their first office was in our home, where dad would say, I've got this great deal, I've got this great thing I'm going to do, it's the best thing ever. And mum would say, I'm just having a look at the figures. Based on the figures, we're going to be worse off than we were before. And dad would go, how do you figure that? And there'd be some complex kind of tax change associated with it. So I used to say to my little brother, Nick, just make sure when you're learning about the Fordham Company, you're learning from Veronica Fordham just as much as you're learning from John Fordham, because otherwise you'll be the most flamboyant, charismatic character in Sydney, but the business will go down the drain. But poor.
Yeah.
Mum's just got this wonderful ability to stay calm in any situation. And, you know, the other thing I've learned from her, Mark, is that she never, ever, ever squeals about anything. So you can tell something to my mum, she will never, ever, ever let slip on it. And if someone else says to her, oh, apparently Mark Burris, la 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 la. Now, Mark might have told her that the day before, and she will still go, oh, really? And I've watched her do it, and I go, mum, you knew that. And it's no big deal. It might be that Mark broke his leg, right? It may not be that controversial, which someone will say, apparently, oh, Mark Burris broke his leg yesterday. And mum will go, oh, did he? How is he?
Straight face.
Straight face. And I go, but mum, it's not even a big deal. It's not controversial. She goes, it doesn't matter. It's someone else's business. And I don't get involved in talking about other people's business.
Well, that's a perfect fit for someone like John, your dad, Fordo, Jack, who was in everybody's business, in that there was a problem, they'd be ringing him. Yeah. Like they might have got arrested, they might have got caught out doing something.
I've got a perfect example of that. When they were many, many years ago, when they were looking after Andrew Johns, and I'm sure Joey won't mind me sharing this, but Joey, as rugby league fans will remember, got busted with an ecstasy pill in London many years ago. When that happened, he called my mum, not my dad, and he told the big kahuna, listen, I've been busted with an ecstasy pill in London. And he was trying to say, it's okay though, because when the cops got me in the tube station, I turned my head against the wall because there were lots of Aussies around, so maybe no one saw. Mum's thinking, oh no, this is going to be a shit show. And Joey till this day says, your mum asked the strangest question, because my mum's like a, you know, a very saintly kind of figure. She goes, how many? And he goes, what? How many what? She goes, how many ecstasy pills? And he thought that was such a strange question for my mum to ask, but it was a practical question. Well, have you got one in your pocket or have you got 10? Because it kind of changes the situation.
Totally.
Mum then said, okay, one pill, where are you? What's going on? What have you been charged with? Hang on, I'll get John. And he goes, nah, fuck that, and hung up, because Joey knew that get my dad on the phone and Jack would have given him a massive spray and kicked him in the ass, because that was their relationship, more of a father-son. So when they had bad news to share, they'd often ring mum and go, hey, listen, Veronica, can you let John know? So it was quite a good combination between the two of them.
Must have been amazing watching. I mean,
We had times growing up when there was one stage, again, Joey was going to switch to rugby union.
I remember.
You know, this was probably a John Fordham special where there was a Rugby Australia interested and dad probably built it up for more than it was worth. And before you know it, Joey was considering going and big money, and we'd have media running around outside our house. So that probably gave me an early exposure to this business, and same for my brother as well, because he works as an agent. That, you know, Ricky Stewart's first ever rugby league deal was done on our dining room table. Ricky was playing rugby union for Manly. He was so poor that he moved into a share house in Manly somewhere, and dad said, mate, listen, we need to give Ricky your bed. And I might have been 9 years old. I said, what do you mean? He goes, Ricky needs a bed. He's getting your bed. Don't worry, you'll get a new one. You'll get a double bed. Right? So I gave my single bed to Ricky Stewart living in a share house. He went from that to being offered money to play rugby league. And the first deal was done downstairs at our family home. And we were upstairs listening through the cracks between the steps, Sarah, Ben and Nick Fordham, the three kids, and we were listening in. And because we knew Ricky well and we loved Ricky, he was part of our family. And I remember my dad, we couldn't hear the figure, but a piece of paper was handed over with the figure on it to dad. And dad said, well, I don't want to spoil this beautiful bottle of red wine, so why don't we put that away, forget about it, and just enjoy the wine. And then the gentleman from the Canberra Raiders said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Mate, we're in different stratospheres, if that's what you're talking about." And whatever was on that piece of paper was more than Ricky would have dreamed of earning in his first year of rugby league. The official then went out into the backyard, made some further phone calls, then came back in with a new offer. And the next thing, Ricky was a Canberra Raider. So it was great watching those things unfold. And you know what? Ricky has been the most loyal mate to my old man that we could have ever hoped for. He's still got, you know, Dad died a few years ago. He's still got Fordo's bar in his house with Dad's picture there. He will still occasionally ring me out of nowhere and say, "Mate, I had this moment the other day where I was thinking about this or that with your dad." There was a moment where Ricky went through a bit of a crisis 12 months or so ago, football-wise, and Phil Rothfield called me, the rugby league journo, Buzz, and he said, "Mate, have you spoken to Ricky?" I said, "No, mate, I'm leaving him for a couple of days because sometimes after a big loss, he just likes a little bit of fresh air." And Buzz said, "Mate, I think you should call him." He goes, "I think without your dad here, he's used to having your dad here at a time like this." And, you know, I'm like, wow, you know. So you realise, hang on, Dad, I mean, I realised it at the time, but not only was it a hole in my life when he went and our lives, but also for people like Ricky, when you're used to having someone there like that. There's another guy I can think of who's a famous face. I won't embarrass him, but he went through a life crisis as well 2 years ago. And he called me and he said, "Mate, this is the kind of time where Jack would have stepped in." In other words, this is the kind of time where your dad would have stepped in and helped me. So I thought, all right, I better step up, you know. So I kind of get involved in those things as well, as you do for mates when they're in trouble.
Well, but he it's interesting you should say, because I remember I was at a lunch down at Verde, which was one of your dad's favourites, and I just started The Apprentice, and John negotiated the deal for me alongside Nick, your brother, and there was a whole lot of shit going on, like you know usual stuff, journalism. You know, some people think it's a good idea that I do it. Some people have a crack at me and all that sort of stuff. And I'd never done TV before. I had no idea, but it was such a comfort to have someone else deal with it for me, like someone like your father, who you know he had his allies in various publications. Probably not with everybody, but certainly he could get his gang to support it.
Correct.
And then the other mob, will no matter what happens, if one publication supports it, the other mob's always going to go against it. That's how the entertainment industry works. That's at least the way I see it. But it was so comforting for me, like, to be honest with you. So I can actually sort of relate to the stories you're talking about. And Jack had this ability to sort of just to take the problem away from you so you could concentrate on doing what you're doing.
He also had a saying, which was, if you grab the tail, you get the whole tiger.
Yeah.
And that was his way of saying, if someone grabs at you or you get has all a go of us. At you, they get all of us.
Yeah.
And I've since used that with my kids when kids are in the playground and they're going through all the childhood stuff to do with bullying and whatever, and you're laying in bed at night time, and I've done this with a couple of my kids, and I go, "Hey, just remember, what happens if someone grabs the tail?" And the kids say, "They get the tiger."
I heard Gus, right? Phil Gould used that saying once, and he put it.
Dad probably pinched it from him.
Well, I don't know. Well, no, this is about maybe Gus pinched it from Jack, but like Gus sort of said it slightly differently. His words were, "If you pull the cat's tail, you get the whole fucking cat." Mm. And I thought that's a really powerful thing to say. He was talking about in relation to New South Wales State of Origin. So when Gus was a coach in New South Wales, he basically said to the players, if someone from Queensland pulls one of our boys out,
absolutely,
they get fucking everyone.
Yeah.
So it's all in.
Yeah. I mean, mind you, you've got to be prepared with your mates. Sometimes someone will pull at your mate's tail and you've got to say to your mate, "Hey, listen, maybe there's a reason why this is happening, or this might be happening one too many times." But in that first moment, you go in and you go into bat for them. I'll tell you a quick one on Gus if I can, because you brought him up. When I took over doing the breakfast show from Alan Jones, absolutely petrified about what was coming my way. I didn't want to do it. Alan Jones had reigned supreme for so long, I think everyone knows his record. 2 weeks before we were due to begin, my boss, Tom Malone, who's also one of my great mates, organised for me and my team of producers to have a Saturday morning in at 2GB coffee, pastries, bit of a chat about what we're doing and what we're hoping to achieve. And he went through this whole thing and he spoke and I spoke and everyone had a chance to speak. And then Tom said, just wait a moment, we've got someone who wants to join us. And Gus Gould walks in and we're all sitting there going, holy shit. And Gus gave 40 minutes of his best.
Oh, mate.
And you know what I'm talking
as
about.
As an orator, right? Unbelievable.
Oh, and mate, we're all sitting there. We are ready to bleed now for this show and what we're about to do. Any nerves that we might have had leading into it have vanished. And we are wanting show number one to be now. Let's go.
You can walk on water.
Oh, mate. And it was a masterstroke from Tom, but we've never forgotten it from Gus because he just wandered in there on a Saturday morning. And I said to Tom afterwards, mate, out of interest, what does it cost to get a 40-minute one-on-one Gus Gould? He goes, mate, zero, because that's the way Gus is.
And he wouldn't have prepared for it. He just would have done
it. No, he just walked in. Yeah. Tom said, look, when I was running Wide World of Sports, I was obviously working closely with Gus. He goes, Gus and I get along really well. Gus is a relationships kind of guy. Gave us 40 minutes. And he looked around the room and he went, so when this bloke's in trouble, who's going to have his back? Because that's what it was all about. It was all about, are we going to be looking out for each other or are we going to be looking out for ourselves? And, mate, I'll tell you what, 40 minutes goes a long way when you're in a tough battle, ruthless environment. You never know. You can't control the radio ratings. You've got to do your best and hope for the best. But I'll tell you what, it was a very, very informative 40 minutes from Gus Gould.
And the Gus Gould leaves you in that position where you'll remember it for years. Like I remember that speech he made. That's probably – I was running Wiz in those days. We're probably talking 20 years ago when he did it, and I just couldn't believe it. And you come from really good broadcasting, entertainment, journalistic credentials, okay? And we just covered off that off here. That's how you grew up. So when did Ben Fordham – recognize that he's going to be involved in that industry? At what point in your life?
I used to go into radio stations with Dad on weekends because he had a wine segment.
I remember.
Yeah, his other great love was wine.
Yep.
And so he would do this segment on a weekend, which was basically a bit of a scam because if you were doing wine segments on radio, then people would send you wine, you know, because you'd have to review it. So, but we'd accompany Dad into that and I'd look around a little bit and that was my first taste of a radio station. I remember lots of people swearing and telling rude jokes and I'm 13, 14. I thought I can't believe this is a work place. And then I did a week of work experience with Alan Jones when I was 15. And during that week of work experience, I stepped into the sports department and that's where you find the real characters. So Ray Hadley was running the sports department. And Andrew Voss was working in there and Andrew Moore and a whole heap of other people. And then someone let slip during that week when I was ducking my head in there. They said, oh, there's a job on Sundays on the rugby league coverage on the continuous call team. So I then contacted the boss of 2UE, John Brennan, and I said, look, I want to do it. And he said, mate, how old are you? And I said, I'm 16. I'm coming up to 16. And he said, oh, mate, we can't have someone who's 16 in there, like, you know, on a weekend. Or I said, well, look, why don't I do it for free? And then if it doesn't work out, there's no harm done, no issue. I'll just do it for free to start
with. What was the job?
It was answering phones, buying lunches, and listening to the opposition. So they wanted me to listen to the other radio stations covering the rugby league and to know that we were crossing around the grounds, doing score updates more often, any breaking news, make sure we had it first. So it was basically cross-referencing, keeping across what was going
Hustling.
On. Hustling. Hustling, mate. And I didn't have a license. I was 16. So when you'd have to go and buy everyone's lunch, I remember getting back with the lunch and they go, what took you so long? I was like, well, I had to walk to St. Leonard's. They go, you walked? Why didn't you drive? I'm like, mate, I don't have a license. I'm 16.
That's when 2GB was on the other side of the hospital.
Yeah, on the Pacific Highway there at Greenwich. So that started it. And then I worked there all through year 11 and year 12, every Sunday. So, mate, there were so many – my mates remember 18ths and 21sts and all these things. They go, we still remember you trying to explain to us why you couldn't be at a piss up somewhere. And I'd say, but I'm working, you know, and they ended up paying me. I got paid $60 for every Sunday, for every shift. I think I did 10 hours and I got $60, $6 an hour or something. But it was a beginning and it was a foot in the door, and it taught me to have a look around, see how everyone else was doing it, work out who did things well and who did things better than others, and basically pinch a little bit from everyone. And then when I was finishing up school, they'd offered me a job when I was in year 12 working on the Commonwealth Games, 2 weeks straight. But I went to mum and dad and I said, look, I've got 2 weeks on the Commonwealth Games. It's a big opportunity for me. And they went, mate, you're at school. You're not getting 2 weeks off school to go and work in radio. So I went back to the bosses and said, look, I've got to go to school. And they were like, oh, you're still at school. I said, yeah, I'm still at school. And then one of them said, well, you need to come and work here full time when you finish. So I did a cadetship in the newsroom. I didn't want to do news because I was a sports guy, but dad said to me, you'll never look back, because news has just got so much to it. Like, you know, it gave me a love of politics. I ended up being a political correspondent in Canberra at about 20 years of age, and John Howard was the prime minister, and, you know, watching the way politics works, and, you know, and you realise the big sports stories end up becoming news stories anyway. You know, when there's a performance-enhancing drug scandal or salary cap or whatever, the sports guy ends up losing that story and the news guys end up doing it, right? So dad said, you'll never look back, and he was right. I just discovered with news that there was so much to it. And also because dad had kind of worked in sport a lot, I thought that this is maybe my way of stepping away a little bit from their field and making my own mark in the news business.
But were you always that strategic? Because that's pretty strategic for a young kid to take $6 an hour to put himself out when all the other kids, all your mates in year 11 and 12 were going out and having their fun and stuff like that.
Absolutely. Working through all those. Strategy.
Are you a strategic person?
Yeah, absolutely. But you know what it is? It comes from fear of failure and nothing else.
Because that's what drives your strategy?
Big time. As in, when I was at school, I knew I wasn't the smartest kid in class.
Academically.
Right? Academically. I knew I wasn't going to be...
You're probably not interested.
Well, I was interested, but I was more interested in what I was doing on weekends at the radio station. So I knew, I thought, hang on, Latin and algebra and all this shit that I'm doing here at school, I knew this is not going to be my future. So strategically I thought, I'm not going to play footy in the first 15. I'm not going to play cricket in the first 11. I'm not going to be ducks of the school. I'm not going to be... And I've got this thing that I'm quite interested in radio. So I think the fear of failure drove me to go, well, you better lock this thing down and put some energy into it, because you know you're interested in it and you've already got a bit of a head start on everyone else. So while other kids were going off to uni to learn how to be a journalist, I was covering stories. You know, like the first story I ever covered as a journo were the kids who got 100 in the HSC, right? I was in their same year. I was a long way from 100. So, but I thought to myself, these five kids have trotted out for all of us today, and those five kids are probably going to go on to be big-time players in this country and in the world. They're the smartest kids out of my year, but they're not being paid to be here today. I am. You know, I was there as an 18-year-old cadet reporter, and all I knew was, all right, well, at least I'm out there and having a go. These guys are all going to go to uni for the next however many years. Uni was never going to be for me. I come from a family of workers. We like getting out there and having a go and earning a buck.
Ben, where's that canniness come from though? Like that's sort of pretty mature. Would you consider yourself a mature kid?
Yeah, but, you know, I'll talk about the fear thing again, right?
No, but you might have the fear, but you're able to deal with the fear by being very canny. So I'm doing my fear. I'm going to be strategic.
Doesn't it make sense? Okay.
No, it totally makes sense.
Doesn't it make sense that if you feel that you're good at it, you do more of it? Like I used to give the example of people who are particularly good at something in the media business, and they'd go, you know, I just keep getting sent to do the same thing. And I'd go, that's because you're really good at it. Like if we go back to Andrew Johns, like if Andrew Johns throws a killer pass, does he get sick of passing it and putting people into a gap and people scoring tries? No.
He gets rewarded for it, yeah.
Right, so if you're good at something, you keep tapping it. So I kept tapping this thing because I thought, I think I'm pretty good at this and I've got a good understanding of it. I've hung around radio stations a lot as a kid, so I may as well run in this door. And then when I ran into it, early on I started kicking a few goals. You know, I won some awards. I was sent to Canberra to be a political correspondent. I started getting recognised what I was doing. And so I thought, well, do more, keep going, you know, because this is working well for me. But that fear of failure, I'll give you another example. When I'd saved $15,000 after working for a couple of years. I gave the 15 grand to my mate, Matt Hayson, who's a real estate agent. And because again, I thought, okay, I've gone okay here the first few years, right? Everything's going well or whatever, but fear of failure. What if everything F's up? I need something. I need a roof over my head. And like looking forward now, 2024, with what's going on and how hard it is to get somewhere to live, I knew then at age 19, 20, this is good now, everything's going well, but it could F up and I could F it up. I need a roof over my head. I gave $15,000 to Matt Hayson and I said, back then that got you 150 grand. And I said, you find something for me. And he goes, what do you want? Where is it? I said, it's up to you. You're the real estate guy. You find it, I'll buy it. About 3 or 4 months passed and he called me one day. He goes, I found it. It's not far from here and I still own it. It was a little studio in Potts Point for $139,000. And I bought it and it was the start of my real estate kind of journey because that's the other thing I love. I love property. But again, that was me thinking, hey, it's all good today and I'm going well, but you just never know what's around the corner. So strategically, I was thinking, grab something now just in case the party ends tomorrow.
And you think that that's – obviously you've done a bit of reflection but these days, but do you think that's come from your fear of fucking things up? I can say yep. You don't want to say it. Because,
yeah.
But on my show
– It's the fear of fucking things up.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. So fear is a driver for you.
I think so. I think I
– In terms of business success or in everything?
In everything. I think I looked at all of these people, you know, who I grew up around through my parents. They're all top of their game. So there's a little bit of that plays in your mind as well, where you go, okay, mum and dad are really good at what they do because everyone tells me how good they are, from John Laws to Mark Taylor to Mark Burris and all these famous people.
Prime ministers, premiers. Right,
yeah, and they're all saying how wonderful John and Veronica Fordham are and I know how well Mark Burris is doing and I know how well Ricky Stewart's doing and I know how well the Johns boys are doing. There's a little bit of intimidation as well in going, all right, well, am I going to be good too? Because I want that. I want to be able to kick goals and do well and then hopefully be able to provide for my family and the nice holidays. And I still say to my kids now, you know, I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to do a breakfast radio show. And if I get any hint from my kids at all about, you know, that they're taking the piss a little bit, which they don't, but, you know, sometimes they might be, oh, can I have this or can I have that? You know, I've got no qualms about letting them know, hey, listen, you know this swimming pool that we're swimming in? How do we get this swimming pool? And they'll go, because you and mum wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. My wife, Jodie Spears, until recently was the early morning news reader on Channel 7 before sunrise. She's now had to let that go after working at 7 for 15 years because she's studying law. But for a long time there, the alarm went off at 10 minutes past 3 every morning and Jodie and Ben are out of bed and off to work. So I let the kids know when you're in the swimming pool, the only reason you're in this pool is because your mum and dad get out of bed and you move their ass at 10 past 3 in the morning when it's still dark and everyone's still asleep.
Did Jack do that with you guys? Or Veronica?
Did what?
Say the same thing to you guys. Did you and...
Yes. Yeah, yeah. They would let us know. They would let us know when we're on a holiday that this was not normal. They would absolutely let us know. Just so you know, this is not normal for kids to go to Disneyland. We went to Disneyland as kids, you know, and they would absolutely, dad more so than mum, would just have that pause moment and say, it's not normal for kids to be going to Disneyland, right? The reason you're going to Disneyland is because of the sacrifices your mum and dad have made. They both quit well-paying jobs to set up their own business, turned a garage into an office, you know, lots of sacrifices, lots of hard work. And they would let us know that because of that, you're able to enjoy some of these things. But they were also very good at kicking us in the ass when we needed it. And, you know, some of those lessons flow through to me where our kids do pocket money jobs, you know. Sometimes who wants a pocket money job? You know, it's $2, $5, $10 if they're lucky, depending on what it is. It's usually something I don't want to do, you know. So Freddie very proudly let me know recently.
Freddie's your older boy.
Yeah, Freddie's 9. he very proudly let me know that he's getting close to $500 that he's made right over time. That's from getting money at birthdays from nanny and, you know, whatever, and some pocket money jobs and whatever. But, mate, there was also a time where we'd bought him some new sneakers and he wore the new sneakers down to his mate's place down the end of the road, Jack and Will. He'd taken the sneakers off and he left them out on the curb while they were all playing for a few hours and he came back, but it was rubbish chuck-out day. So if you're leaving something on the curb, people think that you're chucking them out. So he came back and said, they're gone. And I said, mate, what do you mean? Anyway, I sent him back down there searching, can't find them. I said, mate, you better go and get your piggy bank. And Jody kind of looked at me and went, what are you doing here? I said, mate, I reckon they're worth $50. Give me $50. I took $50 out of my son's piggy bank to show him that those shoes were not free. So when I told that to a few people, they were like, you asshole. But Freddie got it. He totally got it. I thought he'd be blubbering and whatever. He went, all right, I've still got $450, you know. But that was my way of saying, hey, mate, you know, nothing's for free. And mum and dad were big on that with me. I know you had a lot to do with the Packer family, I know. You have over the years, you still do. There's a famous story as well. I think Kerry left a tennis racket somewhere.
And he got sent back to Geelong Grammar.
Where do you reckon I got the $50 idea from?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say to you.
From reading that book and thinking, hang on, I'm not Packer money kind of rich. I'm doing okay. But
if it's good enough for a billionaire.
Big time.
Yeah.
You want them to know.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Do you think to yourself, though, that you might be over-disciplined in that regard? I mean,
we were certainly disciplined.
Because like today, most families, the kids rule the house. Like, I mean, you're doing the opposite way.
Oh yeah, not in our house.
Yeah, you're going the opposite way.
Yeah,
and Jody's happy with that.
Yeah, Jody's happy with that.
Yeah,
there was a discussion early on about physical punishment.
And what's the deal there? What do you do?
Because I've always said to Jody, I said I'll always reserve the right to smack our kids. Jody goes, I don't think we need to be smacking our kids. I said, oh, no, I don't intend to.
I reserve the right.
But I reserve the right to. And I've let them know that over the years. You know, I've said, you know that some kids get smacks. Do you guys know about smacks? Because it happens. And I reserve the right to if I feel I need to. But it's weird. I haven't had to. And one day I tapped Freddie on the chest. Like I'm talking, tapped him where he was doing the wrong thing. And I went, mate, what are you doing? And he gave me this look. I've never forgotten it. It broke me. He looked at me like, what was that? Why are you doing that to me? And I was like, mate, I'm just letting you know. You're going to burn yourself or you're going to – but that tap on the chest, oh, mate, it hit me, the way he looked at me. So –
but I bet you had an impact on him though, that he stopped doing what you asked him to
stop. And I think we've got an arrangement. They know that I'm a tough operator. There's lots of love in our household, lots of love, but there's lots of discipline too. And no one's taken the piss. I don't care how old you are. No one's taken the piss and there's no free rides. So, but look, we got the tough discipline from Dad.
Particularly,
big time. We had the shit belted out of us.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Dad had a belt. He'd take the belt off.
Yep. You knew it was on.
And we copped the belt. Mum had the wooden spoon. But when you really knew you were getting it was when Dad, the car phone was the worst frigging invention in the world. Because for me and my little brother, it gave Dad the ability to ring us from the car and let us know what was happening when he got home.
Yeah, I'm on my way home.
Oh, holy shit.
Wait till I get home.
Holy shit. He'd say, you just wait. And so for the next 25 minutes, you'd be, mate, we'd put on extra pairs of undies. We would. We'd put on three pairs. He had a white belt. I think it might have been the fashion at the time. It was like a white, ostentatious bloody leather belt. And it was thicker than the rest. So we would go and
hide it.
And put on three pairs of undies. And then probably 50% of the time we didn't even get a smack. But we got the shit scared out of us. But other times we did. There were smacks, there were hits, there were whatever. And I always presumed I'd be the same.
But you're not bruised.
No. We needed it, Mark.
Yeah.
Nick and I needed it. It probably had a different impact on Sarah, my sister. Different person, different gender. You know,
she's younger
and,
too.
And she's older. She probably didn't cop as much of the physical. She wouldn't have copped as much of the physical smacks. Certainly not into the teenage years like we did. Dad wouldn't have done that to Sarah. But, you know, the discipline, the tough discipline, Nick and I have probably, we feel like we needed it. and it's helped us.
Were you a bit wild, the two of you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Nick got caught for everything. I never got caught for anything. But we were always looking for fun. That was Dad's personality too. Dad used to tell us a million stories about smoking at school and getting busted with cigarettes and wagging school and all these crazy things.
Because he's a real character.
And pranks and whatever they used to pull. And then we'd do it, and then Dad would get surprised, you know, that we were doing it. But you know what? He was great too. That I had a couple of close calls at school where I was close to getting punted, and Dad came into school and went into bat for me. And boy, he was good.
On his feet.
Oh, mate, he was so good. Like, I remember I walked out of the headmaster's office, and he was a priest. And my mum said, "I think you're a little bit too aggressive," to my dad. And I said, "I thought you were phenomenal. Geez, you were good."
It sounds like a scene out of Scent of a Woman. Remember, is it Dustin Hoffman?
Yeah, Al Pacino.
Al Pacino, that's what it was. It was fantastic.
Yeah, there's that great last blind. Scene. Yeah, he was blind. There's that great last scene where he turns up at the school assembly.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. So there are a couple of close calls there, but I want the same for my kids. I don't want my kids to be boring. I want them to have as much fun as they can. They're not going to get in great trouble with me for playing up. If they're lying about it, different story. And they're getting better at that, where they kind of realise, all right, there's an easy way out here. You just tell the truth, you know. But so sometimes that can be hard to get to.
You sound like you've got a perfect relationship with Jody and the kids.
I don't know about that.
Nothing's perfect.
Touch wood.
Nothing's perfect, but like in terms of most of the structure of the whole thing, it's going good. It's going good. You sound like you've got a really good family life, a really good family. And you've definitely got a great brother, great sister, great mum. Your dad's, of course, passed away. Your family's got a really good reputation. Then there's Ben Fordham, though, who has to build his own position. You know, you're doing all the things early days. You know, went to Canberra be a political correspondent and all that sort of stuff. But there's Ben who comes along to Channel 9, back to Channel 9, many years later, probably in his late 30s, I guess. And you started doing fill-ins for Carl, and you did the Today Show for a while. Then you did Ninja.
Australian Ninja Warrior.
You weren't really doing what you're doing now. You were sort of, but it looked like someone from above was preparing you for all these things. During that period, though, did you ever feel unstable? Did you ever feel as though, like, I want my own gig? I want my own.
No.
You were happy just because you're sort of like a fill-in dude.
Yeah.
To me.
I did. What happened is I was offered two great jobs at the same time. Drive time host on 2GB.
That's in the afternoon.
Yep. And being the sports guy on the Today Show on Channel 9 alongside Carl and Lisa and Georgie and Richard Wilkins. Two at the same time, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. I said I'll do both.
Yeah, which worked.
Yeah, and I did it for 4 years. I said to Jody, I'll only do it for a year. I did it for 4 years, and I loved it.
Did you do the drive time? You did that only for 4 years?
Yeah, no, I did it for longer.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah,
but I did. So I was waking up in the morning doing 3.5 hours of Today Show, and then 3 hours of drive time in the afternoon. A lot of broadcasting. But I thought, no, I'd take every opportunity as it comes. And if there was someone above who was kind of looking out for me, or there probably are a few of those people, David Gingell is one of them. David Gingell, who when he was running Channel 9, was a great friend of mine and also a great boss, but he also knew that I loved radio. So at one stage I said, mate.
He was also a great fan of yours.
Yeah, but I said to Ginge, look, I want to go and do this, and that means I'm going to leave the Today Show. And he goes, well, let's not make any drastic decisions. I said, no, I just want to focus full time on the – whatever I did, he'd try and talk me out of it, but then he'd come on board and he'd support me. You know, so Tom Malone is another one who's my boss at Nine Radio.
He used to be the boss at the Today Show.
He was my boss at the Today Show. Bit of a lesson there as well. Dad used to always say, be good to work experience kids, because one day one of them will become your boss. Tommy was my work experience kid. He was one
really?
Of them.
Really?
Yep. And he's now been my boss twice, once at the Today Show, once at Nine Radio. So thankfully I was good to him when he was a work experience kid. Ginge kind of was very good to me in allowing me to chase my dream in radio. And, you know, I got my own show doing the drive time thing, and then all of a sudden Tom said to me one day, mate, Alan Jones is retiring and we need you to step into Breakfast. And I said no, I think six times. But Tom then... basically, he showed me a chart that was that showed me the success of my show on in the afternoon on Drive and the revenue that came to it. And he said, and it was successful. And he said, we need that in at the start of the day. And in the end, I thought, I trust Tom. I trust my mum. I trust my brother. I trust my sister. I trust my wife. They all think it's a good idea. I think it's a shit idea. Maybe they're right and maybe I'm wrong. And it went against everything in my DNA because I trust my instinct, Mark. But on this one, I went, well, hang on a moment. And this was a lesson for me as well. Why is my instinct any more accurate than theirs? There's five of them. There's one of me. Five of them think it's a good idea. One thinks it's a bad idea. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to throw caution to the wind. I'm going to go with them. So I said, okay, I'll do it. And then on the Sunday before my first show, mum and my brother and my sister came around for breakfast and I started crying my eyes out over breakfast, like bawling my eyes out in front of my children, in front of my wife, in front of my mum.
But anxiety?
Yeah. And they said, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm not okay because I didn't want to fucking do it. And I said I didn't want to do it and now I'm doing this thing. And I was so pissed off about it.
With yourself?
Yeah, because I was like, I should have trusted myself and not caved into everyone else. And now I'm starting this thing and I...
Yeah, you're leaving an award-winning show and going into a show that may or may not make it.
Yeah, you know. And I'll tell you, I mentioned David Gingell, right? Now, I'm going to make these numbers up because I'm not good at remembering ratings, radio ratings, numbers and whatever. But say Alan Jones finished on a 16% share, which is pretty bloody good. Ginge was texting me the day before and he goes, good luck, mate, I'm with you. And I said, mate, hoping for the best but expecting, you know, bracing for the worst. I thought if I end up with an 8, you know, Alan was on 16. If I halve his audience, if I end up on an 8, I'll be able to deal with that. And then I'll climb from there. He wrote back, he goes, mate, I know you better than that. And he had like laughing face emojis. I said, mate, I'm not joking. He goes, mate, I know you too well. I said, mate, I'm serious. I was bracing for that. And I think the first ratings came out and we rated 17. We went up, I think, or either 16, 17. We stayed the same.
I still remember it was close.
Yeah. And I was like, and then we went up. We certainly ended up going up above that 16 and now we've kind of stayed and no one left.
In terms of advertisers?
Advertisers.
Or audience.
And audience. No one left. More advertisers came because Alan had some advertising problems because of some statements that he'd made that got him in trouble. But now every ratings day or most ratings day, so I get a message from Ginge saying, mate, how's that 8 going, you know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I-
One again, of the great communicators.
Yeah, I was worried, you know, why am I risking all of this? And occasionally I ring Tom, my boss, and I go, you know what, mate, you made a good call, put me in there because I reckon I'm actually pretty good at this.
So how long have you been doing the morning
show?
3 years. 3 years now.
Yeah.
So the morning show, I mean, I listen to it. I'm unfortunately or fortunately, I'm in the 5:30 club. And in fact, I'm at the 4:30 club, but your 5:30 club starts at 5:30 club.
Yeah.
And I actually listen to, who's on before you now? It used to be Luke. Who's on before you now? Who's on before?
Mike Jeffries is on
Jeffries.
Now.
Used to be Luke.
Luke Grant.
Yeah, used to be, but Mike Jeffries on there.
You're up nice and early.
I know I am. Yeah, yeah. I'm in the car, so I as soon as I get in my car, I turn. I have the radio on in my house 24 hours a day, and then you know, I get in the car in the morning. The first thing I was to turn the radio on, and because I just like the idea of company.
Yeah,
and you know, like you're one of the first people I hear talking. It was just comforting to me to know that there's someone there I know. So I feel like you're talking to me. That's how it feels to me, anyway. I do want to talk about some of the issues that you talk about. I want to, and some of your guests.
Just on that, I'm the same. Like when I go to sleep now, I've become addicted. I need a voice in my ear.
Yeah, I need the noise.
Yeah, I need something.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so I listen to podcasts, but they can't be podcasts that are too interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Them I need to listen to in daylight hours because they keep me awake.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I listen to podcasts that I've already heard before.
Yeah.
And it's that comforting voice, a conversation I'm already familiar with. So it's a powerful thing.
You know,
it's a great gift that I have to be in people's homes, in people's beds.
Yeah, yeah.
Because some people will text me and go, I'm laying here next to my missus.
Or they're not well.
Right, yeah.
They're trying to recover.
Yeah, 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 you know. But we're in a daily fight against Kyle and Jackie O in Sydney. And usually on the ratings day, it's either me winning or them winning. And I'm number one at the moment, which means chances are by the time this podcast comes out, they'll be number one. right? And we've just accepted that. Kyle and Jackie O accept that. I accept that. And we exchange nice messages amongst each other. But I reckon I work harder, right? And this will get under Kyle's skin. I reckon the reason what I work harder, right? So I'm going to – Kyle has got this –
Kyle?
Extraordinary personality, right?
Yeah, he does.
And he's, you know, captivating, he's controversial, he's everything. But guess what, mate? I work harder. So hard work, you can catch up to people around the edges.
Did you have to catch up to him before? So in other words –
No. I started at number one.
Yep.
I stayed at number one for about a year. Then they knocked me off. Then I came straight back up in the next survey. And then ever since, it's a seesaw, right? And that's fine. Number one, number two, there's lots of radio shows out there who are never going to be number one. And say in the Sydney market where I work, some of these people are my friends who they might be number three, number four, they still do great shows. So I'm very lucky. I started on the number one radio station in town. You know, I didn't build this thing. It's not like you. You've built this thing yourself, right? I turned up at a radio station that's got heaps of listeners.
Can we talk about that? Then let's just talk about it's not – I mean, it's the Ben Fordham Show, got it, but it's not just Ben Fordham. It's
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Let's talk about all the broad shoulders of upon which your success relies. So in your team, just explain to us how you go about building your show for tomorrow morning, for argument's sake. Like what actually happens?
What happens?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I have got the best team of producers and I have consistently had the best team of producers in the country.
What does a team of producers mean?
Well, it means, first of all, young, talented people who helped me put a show together. But the way that I've done that is I created a work experience program when I started at 2GB because they didn't have one. Because I said, where are you going to find the superstars of tomorrow if you don't have a program? So we got rid of a couch and put a desk in there with a phone and a computer. And basically anyone who wants to come and do one day of work experience on my radio show, they can come and do it one day. If they show promise, if we are interested in them, they can come back another day. And then from there, it builds where we start giving them some paid work and then they go into a system of people who we know are there for when we need them. It's like a pathways.
It's a discovery system for you.
It's a discovery system, right? Because otherwise what I noticed is that when I was working at Channel 9, I was working at a current affair for years and years and years, and the boss there, David Hurley, who I love, Hurls used to walk out and go, Burris has quit. Does anyone know anyone? And there'd be 1,000 CVs sitting on his desk. But he didn't have time to go through them. I thought, I need a system. So I've got these brilliant producers and, you know, I've met some of them on street corners. I've met one of them was a talkback caller. He was a talkback caller who we turned into a producer. You never know where you're going to find them. And then we have a WhatsApp group and I've got a rule, which is if it's not in the WhatsApp group, it didn't happen. So it's like if you spot something, if you see something, you put it in the WhatsApp group. And then every night I then go through that WhatsApp group and I work out what all the options are and we put a show together. And then sometimes you wake up the next morning and the Queen's died overnight, God rest her soul, and so you throw out the entire show and you start again. On the morning the Queen died, I think we managed to track down four prime ministers. So we had Scott Morrison, Tony Abbott, Kevin Rudd, and another. I need to work out who the other one was. So,
Albanese.
It's about chasing. Let's chase. Who can we get? Who can we? So a lot of it is dynamic. And
so you go to at 5:30. So
5:30 till 9.
Just give us, by the way, give us an example of what happens. So on that occasion, so the night before, you probably got your show set, you got your talent set on your WhatsApp group, and you've gone, well, so and so go and chase this person and chase, and you've started line your talent up because you've got to fill up the hours for three and a half hours. Queen dies. What time do you get to work that day?
I woke up at normal time, 3:10.
Yep,
and a young bloke, Spiro Christopoulos, who works with me.
One of your producers?
Yep, teenager. He was doing the night shift for us. I also created a night role where someone works at night so that if stuff happens at night, they're across it. He put a note in the WhatsApp group saying all of the presenters on the BBC are wearing black, right? Like us.
Like us.
That's a sign that the media is aware that the Queen may have passed or is about to pass. So that was all I knew. All the BBC presenters are wearing black.
So when you wake up at 3, whatever time in the morning, is that the first thing you do?
That's the first thing I see. Yep.
You pick up your phone, look at
WhatsApp?
Pick
up my phone, I walk downstairs, have a look at what's going on, send a few messages back, and then jump in the shower. So that morning I was like, okay, dump everything, we've got to change everything, and then we need people live out of London. I've just thought who the fourth Prime Minister was. It's our current one, Albo.
Albanese.
So it was, Albo, ScoMo, Abbott, Rudd, getting them on and sharing their reflections of.
So what would happen though? So you would be Spiro ring them?
No, I'd be on most of those guys. I'm texting them.
You know them.
Yep. So I text them and say, "Sorry if you're just hearing this for the first time, but the Queen's passed away. I'd like to be able to talk to you about it on radio once you've gathered your thoughts or whatever." So my team will also be chasing. Like, I'll give you another example of breaking news and the way it works. There was a girl in Western Australia called Cleo who went missing.
Yep, I remember.
She was taken out of a tent.
Yep.
And I remember saying to my guys, listen, I want an update on this every day. And they'd say, there's no update today. I'm like, I don't care. It's day 14. Where's Cleo? I still want to know. Like, this little girl, she's missing on the other side of the country. I want to know where she is. And then on about day 18, my producer at the time, or executive producer at the time, wandered into the studio and just gave me a piece of paper. So I was in the middle of an interview about something else. Say I'm talking to Mark Burris about interest rates, and they just come in and hand me a piece of paper, and it's got West Australian Police, and it's a statement about Cleo Smith. So I wrapped up the interview, said, Mark, thanks for your time. Appreciate it. It's 25 past seven. Now I've got this, and I just started reading it. Now, I don't know whether this is going to say that we've found her, we've discovered that something terrible has happened. I don't know. I haven't pre-read it. And then I'm reading it, and it gets to the part of the officers knocked on the, went into the room and asked the young lady, what's your name?
Yeah.
And she didn't answer. And they said, what's your name, sweetheart? And she said, my name is Cleo. And that was written in this thing. And you go, holy moly, I just started bawling my eyes out live on air because I've got little girls at home, It was one of those moments of, and then the whole show changes. Then I'm like, right, let's get Mick Fuller on, the New South Wales Police Commissioner, right? Mick, what with the WA? Because I thought I'm not going to get the bloke in WA. He's in the middle of this. Mick says, actually, I've spoken to him. He's been bawling his eyes out, Okay, well, we've got some new information. The WA Police Commissioner's been bawling his eyes out. How do we know? Our mate Mick Fuller's told us. He's jumped on the line. So you just respond, you react, and you get as many different people and insights onto a story like that. And if you feel like you're there when it's all unfolding, and this goes back to the companionship thing, so many people wrote to me and said, mate, I couldn't get out of the car. I pull up at work. 25 past seven. I've got to be in there at 7:30.
I want to listen to the rest of the story.
Couldn't leave.
Yeah.
Because you've got to listen to it.
I want to listen to the rest of the story.
And radio's great like that. Radio's resilient like that, that I can find something out at 6:26 and 4 seconds, and I'm saying it at 5 seconds. 1 second, it's as long as it takes for you to open your mouth and you're saying it. The reason I moved more into radio, because I'm a bit ADD, and the reason I favoured radio more than TV is in TV you'd have to go, all right, we need to get the camera crew to go to Carnarvon. Oh, we've got it there. Have we got the link truck? How do we love it? You know, there's a lot of that stuff involved in radio, mate. There's something special like this.
It just happens.
It just happens.
Yeah. It is, when you're talking through that then, Ben, like one of the things that's really, really important in your armory is that you know people. And in fact, I remember when I went to your dad's funeral, like when we went back to your house, your dad's house, your mom's house, there were prime ministers, premiers, all sorts of people there, like police commissioners, et cetera. And it seems as though that a bit like your dad, there's a personable side of Ben Fordham that's really important in terms of Ben Fordham's success or the show's success. Because as you just said, you've got to be able to ring Prime Minister, you've got to be able to ring Mick Fuller, the Commissioner for Police. How do you go about building these relationships? Like how do you do it? Is it because
it's tricky.
But is it because you're Ben Fordham or is
– Yeah. Mate, if I wasn't hosting the 2GB Breakfast Show, they're not taking my calls, half of them.
No, but
Mick Fuller, I'll give you an example. He's a mate of mine. We've become friends, right? But also it's been tricky for me, Mark, because – my boss pulled me aside about a year into the breakfast show and he said, mate, I think you're getting too close to people. I said, what do you mean? He goes, I think you're too close to Gladys Berejiklian. I said, well, I love Gladys. He goes, yeah, well, that's fine. And I said, and I think she was completely stitched up by the Independent Commission Against Corruption and I think it's a disgrace that she lost her job. And he goes, well, that's fine. He goes, but just be careful because – you may need to give him a whack next week. So, and I said, yeah, I get that, understand that. So I've become a bit better at that in just having some polite barriers in place as well where we can be friendly, but also you understand that the next moment I may need to.
Well, that's what I want to talk to you about.
Give you a, and I'll, you know, like it happened with me with Albo, for example. I get along really well with Albo. I think Albo is one of the best blokes in Australian politics of all time.
As a good bloke.
As a good bloke. I think he's a terrific human being. And I remember during the last election, it was him against ScoMo. I get along really well with ScoMo too, but I remember saying to a few people, look, if you saw, here's the issue for ScoMo. If you saw Albo and ScoMo on either sides of the pub and you could have a beer with one of them, people are going to be going to Albo, right? So election over. I'm not saying we all decide our vote based on that, but ScoMo was on the nose. Albo seems like the kind of bloke everyone can get along with. But when the voice to Parliament was being proposed last year, I knew early on that this was going to be a dog's breakfast and it was going to blow up in everyone's face. I've got lots of mates who are Indigenous and I thought this is going to be a catastrophe for them. So I went and saw Albo. I went and saw him privately. I poured my heart out to him about it and I said, you need to change approach. You need to stop what you're doing. You need to switch it. We can still get a voice. You can legislate. He goes, no. You know, and he didn't want to listen to me. I understand it was his baby and he was on a certain path. He'd made promises. But I was, you know, we had two big confrontational interviews last year over it where I really, because I knew, mate, my crystal ball was so crystal clear on the voice. I was telling everyone from day one, from 2022, I was saying, this thing is going to be so problematic. And then when Albo couldn't explain how it was going to work and whatever, I thought, oh, no. It's just going to be a disaster. So, but hopefully if you've got enough respect there with people, I've had a few conversations with Albo this year off air. After he got engaged and whatever, we had a conversation and you move on, you know. So the people, the professionals move on and they understand that you've got a job to do. The sooks throw the toys out of the cot and they think it's all about them. It's like, no, it's not all about you. I've been giving grief lately to the New South Wales Police Commissioner, Karen Webb, for a whole range of reasons. Karen thinks that I'm picking on her. It's all about her. No. I think she even thinks too that because I'm mates with Mick Fuller, oh, you're mates with Mick Fuller, so you're picking on me. No. I gave you a fresh slate and a clean start and gave you a lot of encouragement. And the first time you screwed things up, I let him go through to the keeper because I thought, oh, hang on, she's new to the job. But then when she hid the use of a taser on a 95-year-old great-grandmother in a nursing home, I'm sorry, but all bets are off. That's when I say, no, hang on a moment. You have not been truthful here. Now, they've then got two options in Ben Fordham's world. Cop it and say, okay, lesson learned. We should have been more transparent about the use of the taser. I've learned a lesson for next time. Or you run and hide and you pretend like you can cover it up, get through it, And Karen chose that path. And so, you know, again, I've still, even though we've been at loggerheads, I'll still send her a cheeky message here and there. And I do not hold grudges. I just don't have the attention span to hold a grudge. I don't really care what you've done or what you might have done. I'm willing to move on. But you also want out of politicians. You want people to recognise. Like, I remember Mick Fuller as police commissioner. One of the first things I did is I said, listen, this Lindt Cafe siege, we had the siege at the Lindt Cafe and police didn't handle it as best as they could. And they realised that. They knew that. I said, you're going to have to own up to that straight away. And he did. So he came on the radio. One of the first things he said, Ben, we should have done it better. So it's like, that's what we want. We want some accountability. We know that people stuff things up. We stuff stuff up all the time. You just want someone who acknowledges it.
But do you think that that's when it comes to, say, the two different police commissioners in this example, and as you know, I'm a great mate of Mick's, and do you think it's just because he just got better nous than, say, Karen and or Karen might be not as well advised as he was? Because Mick had Grunter.
Advisor. Right-hand man.
Do you think it's...
No, Grant Williams is a very, very smart bloke, but no, it's Mick Fuller.
Yeah, so Mick had more nous.
It's in your DNA.
Yeah, yeah.
It's in your DNA.
So when it comes to someone's response to you, how do you deal with the fact that someone like Mick had much more better DNA or better nous when it comes to how to deal with media outlets like you, compared to, say, Karen Webb? Because Karen's a nice person. I like her.
Yeah.
But she just doesn't deal with media as well.
Yeah, I'll tell you what it is. You got to pick up the phone.
She does.
Pick up the phone, yeah. You got to pick up the phone and have some difficult conversations with people. And my complaint about Karen is I've said, look, she avoids difficult conversations. She's been avoiding them with me. She's been avoiding them with all sorts of people. Now, the first difficult conversation in the example I gave about the taser is that when she was sitting in her office and when someone said, so they had the word taser in a press release, and then someone said, let's take the word taser out. She should have said straight away, bullshit, put it back in. Like, this is going to cause us so much more grief if we try and cover this thing up, right? It's bad enough that a 95-year-old great-grandmother was tased in a nursing home. Let's not make it worse by us trying to hide it. So you've got to have uncomfortable conversations and say to people, like, instinct would have said there and then in that room, no way in the world, put it in there. It's like, I don't want it to come back on me. I don't want to be part of a cover-up or an alleged cover-up. I think instinct does play a big role.
But your instinct, Ben, has been largely knitted together over a long period of time through your dad and your mum.
True.
Being exposed to these things. Yeah. Let's just say, and I'm not here to make excuse for Karen Webb, but I just want to explore this with you. Let's say Karen was a police officer and a good police officer, but never had that same DNA grafted onto her. And has relied heavily on her advisors who maybe not that good.
Yeah. Who, that's a distinct disadvantage.
Yeah, totally. But
what you also need is you need two people to ring. We always need two people to ring.
Yeah.
Now, I've drafted emails before that I was about to send and I've called one of the two people I call at a time like this, and sometimes they change, and I'll say, I'm about to send this email. And the person on the other end of the phone will say, do not send that email. And I go, because I'm firing up at the time. Someone's done the wrong thing by me. I feel like I've missed out on an opportunity. I'm pissed off. I'm angry.
Unfairly dealt with.
Right? Unfairly dealt with. I'm going to write this. And they go, don't send that email. And then you don't, and you wake up the next day and go, thank fucking Christ.
So someone who comes from this environment always relies on sort of testing the idea.
Yeah, you need people.
At least two people.
To say like someone like Karen, right? In her role, she should have at least two people who aren't in her office.
I'd love to know who they are.
Yeah, who you can ring, right? We all have them in our lives.
She might not have them.
She may not have them, but you need people you can ring. Now, equally, I've had some of the people who helped me out who've called me and said, I'm about to do this. And I go, no. Sometimes you need someone to talk you back from the ledge. Other times, okay, I'll give you another example. Last year, I was accused of being drunk on radio. I'd been at lunch and I got a hot news tip on something. So I went on Chris O'Keefe's Drive Time show on 2GB and I broke the story. I got off air. Tom Malone rang me and said, have you been to lunch? I said, yeah, how do you know? He goes, mate, I could tell. I said, I'm fine. I might be a bit tipsy, but I'm fine. I'm not someone who has a few drinks and starts saying crazy stuff. I'm like, you know, I still keep my wits about me. I don't start fights and start calling people Nazis. You know what I mean? You could hear it in my voice. Anyway, a few days go past and we get an email from the Sunday Telegraph, Annette Sharp. Was Ben Fordham intoxicated when he appeared on Chris O'Keefe's show? Tom and I looked at each other and we went, what are we going to do here? And he said, I think we tell the truth. And I said, so do I. Easy. Smart bloke. That was his instinct. I was like, that's mine too. Now, sometimes you got.
How'd it go?
Yeah, it worked well.
How did it go? Did she write about it?
I call her. I said, look, this is what it is. In future, Tom's told me in future if I get a hot news tip to pass it along to the other host and they can break it if I've been out to lunch. So lesson learned, you know. But the lesson was tell the truth in the first instinct. It saves you a lot of grief in the end. But also if you've got people around you who can tell you when you're about to do something stupid not to do it, or when you're maybe sometimes shying away from a difficult decision and you really should be taking it. And that's where I'm lucky that I've got those people around me. I learnt that from my mum and dad as well. But
it's an instinct.
We should all have those people around us. You don't have to listen to them every time either. Sometimes I'll call and get advice from someone and I go, nah, I'm doing it anyway. But I'll tell you what, they've probably saved me from.
I have him in my life too.
Who have
one,
you got?
One of his your brother, yeah. but another one's David Gingell.
David Gingell's one?
Yeah. So Ginge and I talk all the time.
Yeah.
Like every week for sure. Sometimes often. I mean, and I will say to Ginge, what do you think, mate? Like, especially if someone's having a crack at me in the newspaper, which happens sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I fire up because I can get pretty fiery and I feel as though, like, I just do a carry on the ring, the guy, dude up and give him what I think, tell him what I think. David says to me, just calm down. Like,
settle down.
Fuck, just relax. You're 60 fucking eight. Stop carrying on. Yeah. Like, who gives a shit?
How many fights do you want to start this week?
He said, you've started enough in your past. So just relax and don't worry about it. And it always disappears. Yeah. It does. It blows over. You're right. I know I never really thought about it that way, but I've always had someone around me who I can pass the idea by.
And they don't need to be the same people all the time either.
No.
Sometimes, you know, Jody, Jodie, I lean on all the time, even to things to do with content for the radio show.
But you're lucky she's in the media. She knows it back to front.
You know, and if I'm about to really rip someone's head off on radio and I'm writing something in advance what I'm doing, I'll send it to Jodie and she'll go, that I'd just pull that one line out or, you know, so it's great to have those people around. But on the idea of calling people and calling on people, can I reveal something about you?
You can.
I called you once.
I remember.
Where we've got a mutual friend who was in trouble and was off the rails in their personal life with booze and all sorts of other stuff that I felt was going to be really destructive to his future. And he wasn't listening to me. I thought, who does he listen to? Boris. So I called you and said, I need your help here. And I'll never forget what you did then. And I know that you would do this kind of stuff all the time when someone rings you, but I said, I need you talking about uncomfortable conversations.
I remember it.
I need you to have an uncomfortable conversation with this mate of yours because he's not listening to me and he's doing things that you may not be aware of, but if he doesn't tidy up his act, he's going to blow himself up. Now, you know how well that bloke's doing now.
Brilliantly.
He's on top of the world.
Yep.
He's got his private life stuff under the control and managed to kick the booze completely. And I look at him now and he is killing it.
And a totally different person.
Totally different person, full of accountability.
But did it on his own too. With some encouragement, but did it on his own.
But that was a phone call when I still remember where I was.
Yep.
There's a park around the corner from my house and I was down there I think it was during COVID. So I was doing outdoor training and I remember where I was, where I thought, this would be cool. Because I know you, but I don't know you as well as other people know you. How do you ring someone like Mark Brewis and say, hey, listen, your friend is off the rails and you may not know it, but he is completely off the rails and I need you to step in and help. You might have gone, mate, it's not my place. But thank God you said, all right, I'll have a word to him.
Which I did.
Yeah.
And I'm really proud of how he's like take control of his life over.
But how lucky are we to have people?
No, totally.
That you can ring.
But some people don't have those people. And that's sort of my point in relation to.
And you're right on that.
I think I am in relation to the commissioner. I want to talk to you about a mutual friend of ours, but also, you know, a person who has to be accountable for a lot of things. His name's Chris Minns, the Premier.
Yeah.
I reckon he's a good bloke.
Yeah.
Irrespective of whether a Liberal, Labor, whatever, he's a good person. A decent person.
I think he's a very good politician too.
And he's a good politician. But sometimes you give him a tickle up. And you make him accountable. And I can't remember what it was more recently, but he was very uncomfortable on the phone to you. I can't remember what it was. It might have been about the housing crisis. I can't really remember what it was. And I thought to myself, my God, Ben really knows how to rescue his position for these individuals. Like, because at the end of the conversation, you say, "Well, thanks very much, Premier," and he just says, "Okay, no worries." So he's one of those guys who basically says, "Well, I'm going to aim up when it's good, and I'm going to cop it when it's bad."
Do you know who I learned that from? The how to end an interview with a nice ending. I learned that from Carl Stefanovic, watching him on the Today Show. So he would do this thing. If an interview was boring, then Carl would find a way of making it interesting. He'd just realise this is so boring. And he'd then change the topic, or he'd just throw this kind of, you know, wild spanner into the works. But the other thing I noticed him do, he had a really uncomfortable interview with someone one morning, really uncomfortable. And at the end of it, he said something like, "Now listen, Christmas coming up, you know, next week, what are you hoping that Santa's going to bring you?" Or something, you know. And it gave the politician a chance to have a bit of a laugh and have a bit of a smile. And he says, "Okay, thanks a lot, PM. See you later." And I thought, ooh, something there. So he's just gutted him for 10 minutes, but then leave people with a nice goodbye. And that's what we do in life. You might have an uncomfortable conversation with someone, but hopefully at the end of it, you go, "All right, mate, well, listen, we'll agree to disagree." And you kind of slap each other on the back and you move on. But here's a mark of how good Minns is. I did an interview with him about he's got all these housing changes that he's announcing, and they're needed because we've got a housing shortage. But on some of the detail, I'm not sure he's thought of all of it through. So I gave him an example. I said, "In your street where you live."
This is the one I heard. This interview I heard.
So what I did was I went, okay.
They changed the rules.
Yeah, what if the housing changes were applied to his street?
Yeah, in other words, someone could put a multi-story block next door.
You can turn your one dwelling into five, and the neighbours on two on either side can do the same. So five homes now becomes 25 homes. So anyway, he's sitting there going, "Oh, holy moly." So, and he realises he stuffed up. About an hour after the interview, my phone rings, Chris Minns. So I said, "Hello." And he goes, "Mate, this is not a phone call of complaint. I'm not ringing to have a go at you. I screwed up." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, he tried to defend the changes. And, "Oh, no, no, no." And I said, "I think you're wrong." Anyway, he gave some statistic. He said, "I've checked it. You were right. I was wrong. I stuffed up." Not a lot of people do that. So what does Chris Minns do? He goes, "All right, there's no point." Like when Gingell was saying here, no point whinging about what someone's written about you in the paper.
It's already written.
Just already written. So he goes, "Mate, I stuffed up. I got it wrong." Anyway, lesson learned for me. He goes, "I'm kicking myself because I spent all Sunday getting ready for that interview." So that's the mark of in public life, you can't afford to hold a grudge. You've just got to wipe your hands of it and move on. And some of the best politicians, I've reminded them before. I go, "You still talking to me? You weren't talking to me." He goes, "Oh, mate," he goes, "well, I've moved on from that. I can't remember what it was."
But what is it about politicians? Because I mean, they're like Teflon. Like a lot of them, nothing really sticks. I mean, there's a certain sort of personality trait within a politician, a good politician.
Yeah.
They can cop it, but it's sort of just, they don't take it too seriously.
Well, yeah, I mean, once you realise that this is the job, you know, I think, again, if someone writes something about me in the newspaper and it's not very flattering, and usually it's your friends who bring it up with you. "Oh, geez, did you?"
Yeah.
"Oh, fuck, I don't want to hear about it."
Yeah.
But I say to them, "Well, hang on, I'm paid to give my opinion. They're paid to give theirs." I mean, what kind of hypocrite would I be to go, "Oh, I'm going to contact their boss," who might be someone I know, and complain about what's been written. But what, I'm going to go on radio tomorrow morning and say whatever the F I want to say? Like, I'm allowed to say whatever I want on radio. It's unbelievable. It's a real gift that I've been given. So, mate, I'm not going to go complaining when someone has a go at me or write something that.
Can I ask you, do you really care anyway? If someone writes something.
Depends who's saying it.
Right.
Do I care what random people who I don't know think? No way in the world. I gave up on that a long time ago. It's like the comments under the stories, you know, on the news websites.
Yep.
And then you can leave your comment under the story. I think I stopped reading those comments in 2007. It was a guy called Lockie Harris who was working for Kevin Rudd.
Yeah, I remember Lockie.
You know Lockie?
Kevin 07.
Legend. Lockie said to me.
He ran the campaign.
Yeah. And we were going for a walk one day and I said, yeah, but did you read the comments under the story? And he goes, you don't read the comments, do you? I said, yeah. He goes, never read the comments, ever. I said, why not? He goes, mate, it's like reading graffiti that someone's left on a toilet wall. Some random person and who's never going to walk up to you in public. Now, if someone walked up to me, because I'm always out and about, if I walked out of here and someone said, hey, mate, listen, can I have a talk to you? And this does happen. That thing you did and the way you're handling that thing with the police commissioner or Chris Minns or whatever, I'll listen to that 100%. But, yeah, I mean, random feedback, negative publicity, mate, you got to take the good with the bad. I don't get a lot of bad publicity, but when you get it, you know, that's part of the business.
So it's important not to be precious then.
Yeah, you can't afford to be.
And I mean, I think, once again, your parents have probably equipped you not to be precious because one of the things that comes out of parents being precious to their kids is the kids become precious.
Yeah.
And what you're doing with your kids, you're making sure your kid's not going to be that type of person because you got to read them the truth and you got to tell them the truth and you got to let them know where the pool came from, the swimming pool from. Yeah. Or you got to know how you got to Disneyland.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you one on that. On Freddie, who's 9, had his first bullying experience last year and he didn't tell us about it. Another kid in our street told his mum and Annabelle told Jody and Jody told me and said, apparently something happened to Freddie today. So we sat Freddie down and said, mate, what happened? And he told us this story about what happened. And it's a kid who kind of does this to everyone, but he just decided on this day it was Freddie's turn, you know, harassing him in the playground and grabbing their hat and stealing their, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I thought, right, this is our first challenge here. So I said, Freddie, there's several ways we can handle this. One is we can go and talk to the school about it. Two is we can go and talk to his parents about it. Three is you can handle it. He said, but I won't let you do it on your own. I'll sit down with you tonight and give you advice on how to go and talk to this kid tomorrow. But do you want to have a go at handling it yourself first? And he said, I want to do that. And I was so proud of him. And this is about not being too precious. If you're too precious, you go, I'm going to march up to the school.
Oh, mate.
Right? And I'm like, no. So anyway, that night I trained Freddie to deliver a 30-second speech to this kid, word for word. I even taught him about changing his tone. I said, no, mate, you've got to change your tone. You're going to walk up to him nice and friendly and say, hey, mate, you got a minute? Come over here. I've got to tell you something. And then when he gets over there one-on-one, you're going to change your tone on him. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know what I'm saying to you guys? Come on, come inside. It's bath time. And you don't move. And then I eventually go, get inside now. That's a change in tone. So when you take him aside, you go, hey, listen, someone saw what happened in the playground yesterday. They told my mum and dad about it. So my dad has told me to tell you 3 things. Never touch me. Never steal my stuff. Never chase me if I don't want to be chased. If you do all those 3 things, we can still be mates. Anyway, so he missed a word here and there and I said, nah, do it again. I reckon we practiced it 30 times while I'm preparing for my radio show too. Anyway, Jody and I go to pick up Freddie the next day and I said, look, he probably didn't do it. Fair enough. You know, it's a bit of an intimidating thing for a kid in year 4 to do. But we knew the kid, right, the kid involved. So anyway, as we're looking for Freddie at the school pickup, I see the kid and I said, g'day to him and he put his head down straight away. And I said, oh, he did it. So then I said to Freddie, what did he say? He just said, oh, yeah, well, I wasn't going to do it again. So then I said to Freddie, all right, he's now going to forget. And this is the strategy. He'll forget. So every time he forgets, just hold up the 3 fingers. So 2 days later, Freddie goes, oh, I forgot. I just held up the 3 fingers and he stopped. I said, right, and now you've got to do it when he's doing it to others. So Freddie will now walk up to this kid when he sees him doing it to another kid and go like that. And this kid said, that was for you. And he goes, no, my dad says it's for everyone, right? So it's like I was really proud of Freddie and going, mate, I can be the dad who turns up at the school gate or go, imagine me going and knocking on some dad's door or some mum and then, you know what I mean? Because of my job and whatever, if it's like, and if you turn yourself into a dickhead and you start, your son did this and my son, they're in your freaking year four. Let them sort it out. And Freddie sorted it out.
I mean, you're talking like the way you're talking to me today is sort of like I listen to you on the radio. What's interesting, and I've never really had a long conversation with you like this, but one of the things I get out of this, Ben, is that you're really intense.
Oh, shit, yeah. In the eyes.
I know, but you're an intense dude.
I'm like a boss of mine, Peter Meakin, who's now at Channel 10. He apparently, he never said it to my face, but he used to refer to me as the Scientologist behind the scenes. He goes, oh, he's a bloody Scientologist. And I said, what?
What? You're not a Scientologist.
He said, no, I'm not. But he goes, the intensity. You know, and that's, I suppose, I don't know. I mean, I'm here in this environment. If I'm sitting around having a drink and I'm probably not as intense, but I'm, you know, I think these things through. And if I think.
No, totally.
And I listen to, I listen to your podcasts and I listen to all these other podcasts and other interviews and I'm stealing nuggets from so many people around the place that I go, oh, I like that. I'm going to use that. So I suppose in an environment like this, I'm also trying to drop a few of my own because you just never know whether someone else might think, all right, well, I'm going to use that when I land myself in that situation.
And talking about intense then, you recently interviewed the Spaniard.
The Spaniard. Oh, yeah.
Which we've had him on our show too, but you got him more recent. But yours, your interview went viral, went mental.
Yeah.
It's a bit out there for 2GB audience, yep. I would have thought. No one would have heard of Spaniard, most of your audience.
Sure.
The younger
You'd
ones.
You'd be surprised. I'm shocked. But you're right. It's not a natural fit for 2GB. No.
So what was that experience like?
Well, that was actually, again, coming back to good producers and good team members, it was a young guy called Michael Ponticello who did the HSC 2 years ago who works with us. He said he's mad on the Spaniard and he goes, we should interview him. We should interview him. I said, all right, well, let's line it up, you know, see if he says yes. And he said yes. I didn't think he'd say yes. He came into 2GB, as polite as a choir boy, said hello to everyone, no bad language, no mucking around, sat down, did the interview, because when he's on YouTube, it's all F and F and F and lad, 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 lad. And I thought that might be a bit hard for the 2GB audience. You need a translator, right, and someone on the beep.
Yeah.
None of that. Different audience, different way of communicating. I think he is a very intelligent bloke. I think the fact that he goes into a lot of these areas where people aren't used to visitors, they're not used to people coming in there and talking to them and hearing their stories about disadvantage and about their culture and their life, I think there's something really to be said for him. He admits, I'm not a perfect person. I've been to jail. I was very impressed by him, deeply impressed by him. And here's the funny thing. I've had all these people, listeners. Oh, I'm 75. We've been watching his videos for years.
Yeah, I follow him. I watch his stuff.
Me and my wife. You know, like I got 15 different messages from people who are 65 plus who said, hey, mate, we've been following the Spaniard for years through YouTube. So you don't know who your audience is, you know what I mean? Because you might think, oh, well, they're conservative, they're older, they're whatever. But, you know, I've got 9-year-olds who listen and I've got 99-year-olds who listen. And some of them might have been to jail. Others might have been the wardens at the jail. So you can fall into the mistake of pigeonholing your audience and thinking you know who they are. But the greatest test of it, though, Mark, is if this guy's interesting, I mean, let's face it, how many boring people are out there? If this guy's that interesting, put him on the radio and he'll make the rest work. Like you don't go out of your way to find boring people to put on your podcast. You might have made an exception for me today, but you put interesting people on and turn the microphone on.
Well, I put people on who I'm interested in, and I for me it's a bit selfish in that one of the greatest gifts that I have been given to me is that I get to sit and talk to people like you and the Spaniard, and I find out things about life that I would never ever have an opportunity to find out. You've been spending your whole life in radio and television and just generally media, and I can get in 1 hour, a whole lot of great stuff from you, and they're all gems for me. And yeah. I could, as long as my ass points to the ground, I would never get the experience you've got in what you've done.
Yeah.
But, and I'm the same as a Spaniard. I'll never get his experience. And you're the sort of same because you get to talk to these people, prime ministers, premiers, a Spaniard, also, Switzer, whatever, these people you talk to every single day of your life. How much gratitude do you feel? Because I know I feel a lot of gratitude. How much gratitude do you feel, Ben Fordham, that you have this opportunity to talk to really interesting people, cover really interesting topics your whole life and get paid for it?
Well, when the gratitude shines through, and this is going to sound like me trying to be a bit soft and a bit, you know, Hallmark card, soppy movie kind of thing, but when I'm really grateful is when we put a story on the radio and people respond to it and people – I'll give you an example. I'm off this week. I've got a week's holiday this week. So someone wrote to me and said, look, there's this little kid called Max, terrible story, leukemia, needs to get to Singapore, needs $150,000. Treatment can't be done in Australia. They sent it to me as a direct message on – Instagram. It was a girl called Betsy Burnett who was actually a contestant on Ninja Warrior. She goes, hey, Ben, la, 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 this is a friend of a friend. You know, okay. I said, I'm on holidays, but my team will look after it. I put in the WhatsApp group, team, I know I'm away, but have a look how cute Max is. Can we please help raise the $150,000? On my way here this morning, Mark Levy's filling in for me. $135,000, $140,000, $142,000, $148,000, $151,000. That's what I get a buzz out of. I've got this opportunity to be able to find people who need help, and there's other people who want to help, but they just don't quite know how to find each other. So that's what gives me a real buzz to be able to connect the two. The fact that I'm able to meet interesting people and get paid and do all the other stuff along the way is a bonus.
It's amazing. You're now going to get hit up by 1,000 people, by the way, after the podcast, because they're all going to come and say, Ben can help me. But it's – I get hit up too. It can be a tough one though, that, because sometimes there's times in which you don't have the energy to do it, or you just think, oh, I've hit my audience up too much, tried to raise too much money. How do you work out what the cadence of that is?
There is a bit of a algorithm to that, if you like, that you've really got to look at it and go, are people going to care about it? Here's my other thing that I do. I don't ask anyone to donate money to anything that I haven't donated to. So I made a decision early on that I thought, if I'm saying go to the GoFundMe page, then I want to make sure that when people get to that GoFundMe page, they can see
Ben Fordham.
Ben Fordham's donated $100.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's like, I will never ever say, can you please go and donate to this if I haven't donated to it? It's costly from my point of view because you're doing it a lot, but it's a way of saying, all right, I've got to put my money where my mouth is. And yeah, I suppose you've got to find your mark and make sure that they're the right people. But I don't know. I mean, people are so keen to help others.
Yeah, like totally.
There's just this. But you know what? They want the money to go to the right people in the right place. So what they trust me with.
Yeah, you're curating for them.
Correct. That means that we've checked the people out, because sometimes, mate, people aren't telling you the truth.
Yeah, totally.
We've checked the people out. We've verified what they're telling us. We've made sure that this is the best course of action, that this kid needs to go to Singapore. You know, it's not mum and dad wanting to go to Singapore for a holiday. You know what I mean? Because there are some people out there who try and trick you or try and do all that. So that's a good word. We curate those people who need help, and we've picked the ones that we think. And then there are others we help off air. But I've had to limit how much help I give to charities, because there was a time there where I'd be emceeing two charity events per week.
Alan Jones used to do it.
Right, I do 100 of them a year. Now I say to people, if it's during the daytime, I'm there. Nighttime. Now, mind you, this Saturday night I'm doing something for the Little Legs Foundation, because I met this family and I said to them, oh, I can't do nighttime gigs anymore because of the breakfast radio. And the mum, Sue Ellen, who's as charming as all hell, she goes, except for us. And I said, yeah, except for you.
Or Ricky Stewart.
or whatever. So yeah, I still.
Because he's foundation.
Yeah, but I try and say, look, I'll still do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm conscious of limiting my time. And also, like at one stage I said to the kids, during the bushfires I had to go out on a Saturday night to go and host something for two firefighters who died. And the kids are giving me grief for going. Why? Where are you going? Why? You know, because we're in the swimming pool and everything's great. And like, I got to go. I got to go and do this thing. Why? You know, and they're giving you the guilt trip. So I said, oh, you want to know why? And I told them, because there were two firefighters going out there and they were out there trying to protect everyone's homes, and a tree fell over and crushed them and killed them. And they got little kids like you. And those little kids don't have a dad anymore. And they've asked me to go and help them out, raise some money for those kids. So do you want me to go and do it? They go, yeah, yeah, go and do it. And then they open up their piggy banks and gave me money, and their own money.
So some of that 450 they've got reduced.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, so I do a lot of that stuff, but yes, I'm also conscious that if you do it all the time and if you don't leave any time for yourself and your wife and your children, I've got the greatest wife in the world. I married well. One of the best decisions I ever made in my life was deciding, righto, this is the woman I want to try and marry, and throwing everything at it. And thankfully she said yes, and we're, you know, 10 years plus and going pretty strong. But I've got to keep her. You know, not that she's planning on going anywhere, but I did have a conversation early on where I said, I just say, you know, our family doesn't really do divorce. She goes, what do you mean? I said, we don't do divorce. So, like, when I say I'm getting married to you, I'm getting married
to
you.
I'm staying married
to you. Yeah. No matter what happens, no matter what we do, I'm never, ever going to walk away from this. Just so you know, in our family, I know it's a bit unconventional, but when we get married forever. So, but you can't take that for granted, and that's why I've got to make sure that I'm-
You've got to work on it.
I'm looking after Jodie, and now she's going to become a lawyer, which means when you get in trouble or I get in trouble, we get a discount on the lawyer.
I mean, you better not divorce her because especially if she becomes a family lawyer. And I have one more question for you, and I think
I've loved having this chat, by the way.
I think it's an important question to thanks, Ben.
This is usually my interviews where now I really jam them with the now that I've got
I just want to know, how do you, someone like you, how do you balance the amount of power you have, and you have a lot of power because you've got the radio and you've got an audience, you've got the mic and you've got credibility and you've got reputation and you're a winner. How do you balance that power position out in your own personal life? So how do you let yourself not get carried away with your power position, or do you just don't think about it?
Good question. Jeez, that's a good question. I think other people do that for you. Because naturally your kids are going to do it every day of the week. They ground you, you know. You might think you're a big deal on the radio between 5:30 and 9, but outside of those hours at home, you're just dad, you know, and you don't have any power beyond that. And also I think your mates are very good at that as well, at keeping you in check. And, you know, we're lucky in Australia that we've got this humour where the more you take the piss out of someone, the closer you are as friends.
Yeah.
So that's a great way. It means that you are naturally going to cop more shit than others are when you go to lunch with people. And if you've been in the media that week or you've had a bit of a high profile week and there's been a this and that and whatever, you know that when I turn up, I'm going to be copping it, you know. And they'll all claim that whoever I was having a go at is severely misunderstood and they all feel sorry for that person, you know what I mean? And they'll say you're this and you. So, you know, that probably helps as well, that once the microphone's off, you know, and you step out of that, then I think you get reality checks left, right and centre. But you probably do need to be careful to not take yourself too seriously.
Because some jocks, journos.
Oh, yeah.
And it has been their demise.
Yeah, and it has. And also, as I said earlier, once the show's over, the show's over. Don't kid yourself into thinking that without 2GB breakfast that Ben Fordham has got some kind of degree of influence around Sydney. Mate, like you do, you're different. You're Mark Burris and you've built yourself away from brands. Yes, you've been associated with many brands, but you turn that microphone off and you take it away from people, and I think a lot of people have realised this. Oh, hang on a moment, you don't have the same level of influence or swing the same level of power as you did last week.
But does Ben Fordham identify himself as Ben Fordham, the dad, the mother, the brother, the son, the mate, grandson, perhaps, or do you sometimes get a little bit confused that I'm Ben Fordham from the Ben Fordham Show?
No, not at all. I don't at all. And all this is another. My boss has told me not to talk about this, Tom.
Good.
So, which is why I'll talk about it, obviously. But I said in an interview recently that I'm going to retire at 50. I'm 47. Tom said, "Oh, mate, can you please not say that again in future interviews?" So I'm going to retire at 50. But I say that too because, and I don't know whether I will or I won't, but I've asked my accountant.
Can I?
Yeah, I just said, for example, what would it look like if, well, mate, you got the kids going into high school, you've got, I said, yeah, I know, but I just want to know. Like, I've worked hard, I've saved hard, I've invested well. If I had to sell a few things or whatever, and the reason I'm exploring that as an option is because I don't want my identity to be tied to this role. I don't want to get my satisfaction in life through that job because that's unhealthy. And I think that's where you're getting
that's
to as
point.
Well.
To
go,
yep.
No, if I derive all of my satisfaction and self-respect and pleasure and buzz out of that job, well, I'm setting myself up for a pretty disastrous life after radio. So I want to do the opposite. I want to explore the option of cutting myself loose from it in 3 years' time.
Or at least have the ability to do it.
And to go, all right, what if I just said I'm done for now and then I just want to see what else is out there? You know, so I'm doing that as a way to go, don't be one of those guys who is so addicted to that job, that radio, that presence, whatever you call it, that they can't let go of it. That's not to say I don't respect people who, John Laws is still on
radio.
Good
example, yeah.
And I have lunch with Lawsy twice a year and he can't think of anything else. You can't think of anything else than being on radio every day. I can think of other things. You know, I've got a property development business that I'm really passionate about that I have with a few mates. We run a motel. We can talk about that some other day. I love the food and hospitality kind of business. I'm fascinated with politics. So I'm kind of like, well, you only get one shot. It's like when the kids have said to me, oh, do you reckon you, is it true that there's an afterlife? Like, I don't think so. I think when you're dead, you're dead.
And do you think?
And that's another one where Jody goes, should you be saying that to the kids? And I go, bloody oath I should, because you've got one shot.
Yeah, make the
You've best got
of it.
One opportunity. Please don't save it for your second life. There is none. I believe in Kerry Packer's version of events when he died and he said, son,
there's nothing
I had
there.
A look on the other side and there was nothing there. Like, I'm a religious person, I'm a spiritual person, and if there's another life, great. But I'm also thinking, all right, when I hit 50, I just wouldn't mind hitting pause potentially and just seeing what else is out there.
So is this driven by your how we first started off the conversation? Would it be seen as a failure of yours?
No, that next part will just be freedom. It's like I feel like, okay, I feel like I've done my thing. I've proven myself in the industry that I chose to. And then I just like, a little bit like David Gingell, right, he got out of the TV business, the king of TV, ran Channel 9, very successful bloke.
The timing king.
Yeah, and then he got out and then he was like, oh, kind of like beer. What about how starting Bolter?
Yeah.
Right? Have a look at
it. From Byron Bay.
Right? I like the idea of being free to think, I don't know, I'm keen to know what my kids are going to get into. Am I going to want to get involved in something that they're doing? I don't know. Or I might just get to the end and go, no, I want to go around again. But I want to have that freedom and I want to feel like, no, I've done my bit in the first half of my life. I might start my own podcast and, you know, try and destroy yours.
Go for it.
You know, instead
Let's
of
Let's do it together.
Instead of me trying to destroy Kyle and Jackie O every day, I might think, righto, what's Boris doing? What are his numbers? How are we going to catch
well,
him?
Well, mate, by the time you do that, if that's in 3 years' time, I'll be like 70-something, so I don't know where I'll be.
Mate, you've done so well with this podcast
equally.
And with your team. You've got a great team
Thanks,
of people
mate.
Around.
Well, you know, success is always built upon the broad shoulders of others as far as I'm concerned. Mate, I just turn up, have the chat, and I do all the interesting stuff. They do all the hard work.
Where's your like notes, by the way?
I don't have notes. There's notes here. They prepare
You didn't even look at them once.
I know. I don't do notes. Mate, that was fantastic.
Thank you so
I really
much.
Appreciate
mate.
It, mate.
Appreciate it.
So good.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.